Greetings. My name is Monk Rowe. I am the Joe Williams Director of the Phileas Jazz Archive at Hamilton College. Thanks for tuning in to our Jazz Backstory podcast. Episode 36 is titled, The Art of Accompanying, a logical follow-up to our previous topic on jazz vocalists. Of all the things that singers may lose sleep over, the number one issue is, who's going to play for me? There are certain jazz terms that have definitions outside of the music world. The first listings in the Webster Dictionary for accompanying read, go somewhere with someone as a companion, followed by, be present at the same time as something else. This actually describes how an effective accompanist thinks. Wherever the singer or soloist is going, I'm going there too, at the same time. Hopefully. Accompanying is indeed an art, and an excellent accompanist are valued and rewarded in multiple genres of music. The piano is the instrument most often called upon for musical support, and in the classical world, the pianist is playing specifically what the composer wrote, while staying alert to the phrasing, tempo, and dynamics that the soloist delivers during any given performance. A jazz pianist frequently works from a lead sheet, sheet music that only displays the melody and relevant chord symbols. Sometimes they get less than that. They are, in effect, improvising, but in a supportive fashion. When done well, a singer and pianist achieve a balance, a musical collaboration that is difficult to define. Joe Williams, the celebrated vocalist and co-founder of the Phileas Jazz Archive, offers some insight on this synchronicity.
First of all, we're not talking about accompanists here. Those of us that understand what transpires between a piano player or a guitarist or an orchestra and a soloist, be it voice or one of the other instruments, is one, what they do, they support the soloist. You make a statement, like the statement might be in the blues, say, you don't love me and I don't even care. Now there's a space there for a piano, a guitar, or a horn to comment about that. People are laughing. The language has, the people are laughing because they don't expect that. They expect, you don't love me and I'm sad as I can be. Instead, you say, you don't love me and I don't even care, And right away, people are laughing. Now, what the piano or guitar or an instrument does is say, yeah, that's so, I know it is, and then lead into the next phrase harmonically, you see. And where a lot of people don't know what's happening or what it's about, you see, a lot of the young people, I'm afraid, are making a mistake of percussion instruments, particularly, that if something is happening and people say, yeah, then they would like to do it as well. I can do that too. And they do it right. They do it with you instead of adding something to what should, is what you should do. You should be able to listen to it and corroborate, maybe. Make a corroborative statement as opposed to, I can do that too.
Joe's words of wisdom about space will be echoed later in this episode. Let's talk about the traditional elements of music for a moment. If you consult music theory books or search the all-knowing internet, You will find lists with at least four music elements. Every list will include rhythm, melody, and harmony. Have you ever been involved in a Name That Tune contest? No one plays the harmony or the rhythm for the contestants. It's all about the melody. Church organists and pianists include the melody when playing hymns. It's written in their music. Accompanists in jazz and popular music rarely, if ever, actually play the tune. The melody is the personal domain of the singer or instrumental soloist, and doubling it from the piano will earn you a look, anywhere from puzzled to pissed off. Norman Simmons, the favorite accompanist of Joe Williams, describes how his formative years of learning the piano set him up to be an effective musical partner.
What makes me a great accompanist is Duke Ellington, first to start with. Duke is what I heard through the floor, and Duke is what I tried to copy. And the thing about Duke Ellington is Duke Ellington wrote for his men, the men in the band. And when I started to play the piano, I didn't start as a piano player. I started copying Duke's band. So it was good to have someone else play the melody while I just make up the arrangement. So in an accompanying, I always feel like I am creating an arrangement behind the vocal line. And that's a great freedom there because I don't have to search for the vocal line. It was a long time before I could even find a vocal line on the piano. But I was creating the harmony and the rhythm, and I got a great kick out of that. And in Chicago, where I was born, it's a rhythm town. So again, that was like a real enjoyment of just being in a rhythm section, being able to make things happen as opposed to being out on the front line. For a long time, I didn't know how to maybe take a solo. I knew how to play in the background. So I think that that has a lot to do with it, the fact that I see accompaniment as creating, composing, arrangement behind the vocal line.
Norman was fortunate to have an upstairs neighbor who played Ellington LPs with great gusto, thus his hearing Duke through the floor. An experienced musician once said, "If jazz improvisation is the spontaneous creation of a melody, then jazz accompaniment is the spontaneous creation of an arrangement." Actually, I said that, and you can quote me. The accompanist is playing a song without one of the key elements of music. Speaking of Name That Tune, see if you can get this one without hearing that element. I'm going to pretend that a singer just told me the song they wanted, followed by this instruction. Just give me a bell tone. Did you get it? Did your memory fill in the missing melody? If not, don't fret. It's not how the game is played. Here's a melodic hint. Ta, ta. Okay, I'll bet everyone got it now. Singers and soloists spread the word about what piano players are best to work with, and the late Mike Longo was one of them. In January of 2019, I visited Mr. Longo in his New York apartment, where he spoke about our topic.
I wanted to ask you about comping behind Joe Williams and Nancy Wilson and Jimmy Witherspoon, and how does a piano player learn to be an accompanist that vocalists want to work with?
Well, without getting real technical, the main word would be listen, listening. And you have to be, you have to have your voice leading together so that you're playing contrapuntally. So the basis of simple counterpoint is when the main theme is moving, you're standing still. When that stops, then you move. And so I would listen to something the vocalist said and play in between his phrases, and then we'd lock up together. And so the singers all like to work with me. Nancy, she told somebody in Florida, Mike Laws really knows how to play for a singer or something like that.
Do you like to see a lead sheet? Maybe you're obviously way beyond this, but when I play behind a singer, I kind of like to know what note they're going to be singing, at least a lead sheet of how song normally goes. Because,
well, the way I look at a lead sheet is information.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, look, man, Aaron Copland said the art of classical music is the art of melody. So melody is number one. And so if the singer's singing the melody, you got to know what, you don't want to be playing something that's going to clash with that.
Yeah.
And so if you're playing contrapuntally, you're playing something that complements. And so you have to be involved with the five elements to music: melody, harmony, rhythm, counterpoint, and form. And so you have to have yourself trained to deal with all five of those things. And if the singer's the melody, then you're doing the counterpoint and the rhythm. And so rhythm is primary. In our music, rhythm and melody almost mean the same thing. Dizzy used to use the term the melodization of rhythm.
The melodization of rhythm. That's what that lick was. Boobadot, boobadot, boobadoobop-bop-bop-bop, boobop. The rhythm gave birth to the melody, just as Dizzy Gillespie described. Sounds like a good lead-in to our jazz vocabulary segment. I used the term bell tone. One pitch, the simplest introduction possible for a vocalist. It can be tricky, though. Some singers like the actual first pitch they need to start on. Others like the fifth tone of the key. It was this latter version I played in our brief Name That Tune selection. Mike Longo mentioned counterpoint. J.S. Bach was the master of it in the classical realm. In jazz, it's an improvised melodic phrase used sparingly that runs counter to the melody. Counterpoint with singers works best when played during the rests or under long held notes. And comping. A singer might say to an accompanist, I like your comping. Or, can you comp less during the bridge of this tune? Comp and comping are abbreviations of accompany and specifically refer to how a pianist or guitarist chooses to play chords behind a soloist. Check out this offbeat guitar comping from our Orchestra in a Nutshell. Nice groove. Guitarist Howard Alden is also a prized accompanist and figured out how to make himself valuable in multiple settings, thus making his phone ring.
Being a guitar player, being in a rhythm section, I get called to play with a lot of different people, you know, more so than a horn player, I think, you know. because a horn player is either going to be a soloist or part of a group sometimes, but usually either a major soloist or else play in a section in a big band.
Yeah.
So I tend to get called to play in a lot of small groups with different people. And Joe Bushkin, again, wanted one thing out of the guitar player, which was thrilling to play with him. He's a great piano player and a great personality, too. Mm-hmm. Right after Bushkin, I ran into Joe Williams, and he asked me to join him for some engagements, which was a slightly different thing. He was very easy to work with, great guy. Ruby Braff, the cornet player, I got to know around New York. I started working with him, and once he saw I was open to suggestions, he would suggest various things to me, too, as far as my accompaniment, as far as my playing, as far as my soloing, even. And Kenny DeVerne, I play a completely different way with when I play with him. So
is it possible to be specific about that?
Yeah, well, okay, well, let's see. First, like Kenny DeVerne basically likes rhythm guitar for accompaniment. He likes, chunk, 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 chunk behind him. It's for soft, nice support for what he does.
Mm-hmm.
And then occasionally I play some parts with him, like clarinet and like that. Ruby Braff likes different, like some punctuations in the chords, like rhythm all the time. He likes sometimes. Uh-huh. Again, he likes you when you do play a part with him. He wants to hear it fully, and Joe Bushkin also, when I first started playing with him, I figured he's playing a lot of piano all the time, so I figured with bass, drums, and guitar, I'll just play light rhythm guitar with him, so I started going, ching, ching, ching. He says, no rhythm guitar, play horn riffs, he wants a lot of active comping and stuff,
Yeah.
He wants a lot of, punctuation and stuff like that.
Right.
So basically, I kind of listen to the players and try to decide what is most fitting for them and what's going to make them feel most comfortable and what's going to make them sound the best.
This is a different art. How to accompany when part of a rhythm section. A rule of thumb, more players, play less. I've always felt that a bassist can make or break a band, especially when the group is in an accompaniment mode. During our September 1997 interview, bassist Michael Moore brought up a key term. Wait for it at the end of this excerpt.
I do a lot of teaching, and I think that the bass is probably, maybe, as Dizzy said, that's the first thing he would get for a big band, was a good bass player. You go from there. And I think it is probably that I wouldn't say the most important, but right in there with the drums and the piano and the rhythm, it's very essential. And the feel, the team spirit that you have to develop as a bass player, I think, is very important. I mean, I don't care about the solos, that can come later, but I always tell bass players, time, feeling is the most important thing that you have to shoot for right away. And work towards that in solos later on, or at the same time, but never forgetting the function of the instrument. And you really have to, in a way, a lot of times a great bass player, I think, is not noticed. I was I correlate it to being a catcher. I used to be a catcher in baseball, and I think about it as kind of the catcher. He's not noticed on a ball field. Until he makes a mistake. And the bass player is kind of the same way. You shouldn't be noticed that much. You should be felt, and the rhythm should sound good, but the bass should, and until it comes to the solo, he shouldn't stand out as by playing a lot of tricks and things like that. There have been bass players through centuries or through the last century that stand out no matter what they do, but I think when you're accompanying, you should not disappear, but not be so noticeable until it comes time to play solos. And that takes a certain amount of almost a Zen attitude of thinking about, the unit and putting yourself out in front in the audience and saying, how is the band sounding? Thinking about the section of the rhythm section as a unit.
Mm-hmm.
And volume has a lot to do with it. You can't be too loud because then you overpower the acoustic instruments on the bandstand. It's very important to set your volume if you're using an amplifier, to the keyboards, because the piano, in particular the acoustic piano, because that can't get any louder than it is. So if you crank up the amplifier, then the whole thing is destroyed. Yeah. You haven't got a chance. So there's a lot of elements that go into it, but mainly being a team player and kind of maybe subjugating your ego just a little bit to do it.
I'm envisioning a book titled, So You Want to Be an Accompanist. Chapter 1, How's Your Ego? Mr. Moore suggested, kind of maybe subjugating your ego just a little bit. In my experience, there's no kind of maybe or a little bit. As Quincy Jones said to all the pop stars who participated in the 1985 We Are the World recording session, leave your ego at the door. I would go one step further and say if you constantly have to subjugate your ego while accompanying, you probably aren't suited for it. Simply put, your ego has to be stroked by the fact that you're excellent in the role. Wise drummers know how and when to be accompanists. Gregory Caputo reminded me that synchronicity scenario is not always with singer or soloists, but can be a collaboration with folks that aren't even in the band, as well as the musicians who are.
When I play for dancers, I simplify. That's what I do. And all the big bands that I perform with have two books. There's a concert book, and there's a dance book. Mm-hmm. And yes, the Artie Shaw big band has a dance book, and I simplify. It's like I give them backbeat and time. I concentrate on the time rather than syncopation as I do in the other book, the concert book. I lay it down and that keeps me working. So when I play for dancers, it's time.
Yeah. To get drum specific, mm-hmm. when you say you lay it down,
yes.
what do you play more of something on your set, less of something on your set? Can you define laying it down for me?
Well, when I play jazz, my for instance, my bass drum becomes a separate voice. There's nothing definite that I play. It becomes a separate voice. Everything mm-hmm. becomes a separate voice, as in bebop. But with swing music or dance music, I will keep an ostinato 4 on the bass drum and 2 and 4 on the hi-hat and a swing rhythm and 2 and 4 on the snare drum to simplify it mostly. And it's locking in the time, therefore just leaving a nice pillow for the other musicians to play on. If they feel confident in the time, you know, the band will sound good and they'll be able to create. And there'll be a, like what we call in the pocket feel if the musicians feel comfortable.
That was a good answer.
Thank you.
I like that. Because it's easy to say, you know, you got to be in the pocket, you know, or any other cliche, but exactly what that means sometimes it can change from one situation to another, I guess.
It does. Each band has a special need. And it's my job to find out as soon as I can, mm-hmm. either from knowing who's on it, just by knowing the personalities, or listening to them play. Within the first 4 bars, I know what I have to work with in the rhythm section and what I have to adjust to.
Here's a rarely heard phrase when referring to a sax, trumpet, or trombone player. Oh yeah, wonderful accompanist. But it's not an uncommon position to be in, playing with a singer. Remember, no melody playing, and no counterpoint that interferes with it. Trombonist Al Gray, known as Fab, for fabulous, spoke about the challenge of playing behind Joe Williams during his Count Basie years.
I used to play all the fills for Joe Williams. where Joe wouldn't sing, and I had, when I first started doing it, I used to have problems doing it. Many years ago when I was with Lionel Hampton, they had a blues singer, Sonny Parker, and he would start singing the blues, and he would get stuck for words, and it would be such a big gap in between until I started filling in these gaps. And so Lionel Hampton said, well, leave it in, Gates. And so that's where I, like, started. So then through history, I come along, and I started playing fills for Ella Fitzgerald and Bing Crosby and for Sarah Vaughan. And see, now I come into Count Basie's orchestra, and I started playing the plunger, making these fills for Joe. But sometimes Joe would sing lyric, and I would cover him up. And so one night Joe didn't like it at all. You know, I don't mind, but, you know, you don't cover up my lyric, fab. I can see him now. And so Basie called me off to the side. He said, here's what I want you to do. Anytime Joe sings, just stay out of his way. Now, if you find a crack to get in there, get in there. See, but otherwise, stay out of Joe's way. And that's when I learned he was like a coach.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he used to tell me. See, because when we made the recording, going to Chicago, sorry I can't take you, and this is where I would make these feels. Quack, 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 quack. And the fact of somebody that they're getting ready to have all kinds of affairs are going on, see? And this is where I could get in there. But if you cover the lyric, which I really did find out, it was very bad. And so that was one of my first lessons.
Years ago, I was on a gig with my guitar vocalist partner. A local sax player asked to sit in and proceeded to noodle aimlessly from the beginning of the song to the end, searching for any notes that might sound good. He's partly the reason I chose this topic. My partner forged ahead, but I could feel his anger mounting. As we packed up at the end of the night, he gave me a look and said, "Don't ever let that guy play with us again." I hope that guy hears this episode. So there it is. Making a living as a jazz musician has never been easy. Establishing a reputation as an effective and sympathetic accompanist can help fill your gig calendar. To paraphrase a local musician and dear friend, your ego won't pay the rent. If you enjoyed this jazz backstory topic, I highly recommend starting back at the top, Season 1, Episode 1. And you can watch the full video interviews with all our podcast voices on the Phileas Jazz YouTube channel. Thanks for joining in. I'll see you on the flip side.